Letters pop out from a white background, then turn red. Netflix. Deep ridges cover the side of a mountain. Words appear. A Netflix documentary. A film by Werner Herzog and Clive Oppenheimer. Directed by Werner Herzog. Produced by Spring Films Limited, Werner Herzog Film, GmbH, Matter of Fact Media Incorporated, in association with Dog Wolf Limited. Fog moves over the mountain's peak. Director of Photography, Peter Zeitlinger ASC. Edited by Joe Beeney. Executive Producers, Richard Melman, Vanessa Dillon, Lisa Nishimura, Jason Spingarnkoff, Adam Del Deo. Produced by Andre Singer, Luki Stipitik. In the distance, fog obscures a group at the top of the mountain. Words appear, into the inferno. Four men stand near a precipice. A man holds a phone over the edge with a monopod. Another man aims a camera downward. Rocky crags lead to the bottom of the massive cliff face. Lava smolders and bubbles in a pit below. Bits of molten rock form on the surface of the lava. A plume of lava shoots into the air and splashes onto the edge of the pit. The lava rises and recedes against the rim of the pit. The glowing magma flares and churns. Now trees stretch away from a shoreline. Words appear. Vanuatu Archipelago, Ambrim Island.
We are here in the Vanuatu Archipelago, a cluster of volcanic islands in the Pacific, about 1,000 miles east of northern Australia.
Buildings stand among the trees.
Below, the village of Endu on the island of Ambrim. A year ago, most of it was destroyed by a tropical storm of phenomenal force. But the village also has to endure the periodic fallout of volcanic eruptions. Punctuated by catastrophes, time does not seem to have found a grip on the community.
A woman pushes a baby in a wooden stroller. Two boys and a man stand nearby.
We met Chief Mile Moses here with members of his large family.
A man sits with the chief on a bench.
This is Clive Oppenheimer, a volcanologist from Cambridge University, who brought us to this place.
Chief Mile Moses, you're the head of this beautiful village of Endu, just a few kilometers from the volcano crater. You visited the crater and looked yourself into the inferno, into the raging fire. How did you feel when you went there?
I feel very frightened to look at the fire. Secondly, I feel that I was not in the island of Ambrim. I thought I was somewhere else. And the other thing, I feel that how powerful that fire is.
Clive nods. Mile nods.
Do spirits live in the fire?
That's how we believe that spirits are in the fire. The fire is burning through that spirit. We believe that the fire is burning through that spirit.
I read that there was a big eruption in 1968 and that there were rituals performed to stop the eruption. And then tourists were not allowed for 3 years afterwards to visit the crater, and because it was seen that somehow the tourists had started the eruption. Is that?
Well, we believe that because we thought that the spirits that are in the volcano, if they look at you, they don't know who is this, okay? But if they look at one of us, they know that because we are more or less related to the volcano, then they will just be quiet. Sometimes we say that the tourists won't go up there, okay? Because you are foreigners to that spirit of volcano.
Miles smiles. In the pit, the lava heaves.
Once I dream about volcano, I saw people in that fire. People and women and men, they're cooking their food in there. So it makes me believe that there are somebody who is the spirit out there.
Waves of lava touch the edge of the pit.
The molten rock, is that part of the spirit?
The lava expresses the angriness of the devil who are living in that fire volcano.
At the village.
Do the ancestors then live under the volcano?
Yes, we believe that anybody who dies here goes to the volcano, and that volcano has become the village where you can talk to them and we can talk to, they can talk to us.
Can you talk to the volcano?
I'm not, because, I'm not related to the volcano. But one of my brother, yes, he was talking to the volcano. His father, when he goes up to the volcano, and if he wants to smoke, he just call out and the fire will come down. And take the fire and light his cigarette or pipe or something like that.
And if your brother talks to the volcano, is he allowed to tell you what the volcano has said, or is it just a secret for him?
No, it's a secret for him. Yes.
Do you try and get the secret out of him?
I've got some.
In the jungle, Mile walks on a path.
But Chief Nile Moses is worried about the loss of their ancient culture. He asked us to follow him to a ritual site in the jungle.
A villager and children reveal themselves in the jungle.
Once upon a time, our people were cannibal. They see somebody and they would like to attack him and kill him so that they should use it for a meat. And this is how they demonstrated.
Miles smiles. The children pose with their arms outstretched. They wear loincloths. Two wear crowns of leaves. Miles watches the children, then turns with a smile. Now a boy follows Miles on a path.
Many people here have lost the dance. They have lost the idea of dancing. Yes. The custom dance that we're going to see this afternoon, my family will perform the dance.
Dried leaves cover the roof of a shelter. Nearby, men and boys wear loincloths and leaf crowns.
This is a happier dance, the happiest dance. After we've gone through a long suffering, then we are happy to go back and dance and to express ourselves.
A man leans over and sings. A man taps a piece of wood. The group dances. They bounce up and down. The group turns. The men lead the group forward. Nearby, a carved face covers a tree trunk. The group stomp their feet. The boys dance in the center of the circle. The group moves forward. They step rhythmically. Clouds fill the sky over the jungle canopy.
I studied here 10 years ago with some colleagues, scientists from Vanuatu. For you, is it strange to imagine that someone would come here to work, to study how the volcano works, how it erupts?
I'm very surprised to hear that you people are very interested in the volcano. I always ask myself, why do these people want to do with that fire? Okay? When looking at this, going to in the helicopter yesterday, I was wondering, why this man is going, he wanted to do with of that volcano? Okay?
Miles smiles and turns to Clive.
Yes, I don't know why you are so interested in volcano.
Now a snow-covered landscape.
In a way, this film started for me 10 years ago in Antarctica. I was doing a film about scientists on this continent, which took me to Mount Erebus, an active volcano, one of the three in the world, where you can look straight into the magma of the inner Earth.
Smoke wafts from a volcano.
Magma is the heated molten rock from which lava can be extruded. It was on Erebus, 12,500 feet above sea level, that I met a strange and wonderful tribe of volcanologists, some of them overcome by altitude sickness.
A camp on the rim of a volcano. A scientist in winter clothing lies on the ground. Snow covers the interior walls of the volcano. Smoke rises from below.
This close to the boiling magma, which frequently explodes, we were briefed on the etiquette of how to deal with the stuff.
A scientist speaks to a camera.
One very important thing to keep in mind when you're on the crater is that the lava lake could explode at any time. And if it does, it's vital to keep your attention faced toward the lava lake and watch for bombs that are tracking up into the air and try to pick out the ones that might be coming toward you and step out of the way. It's the last thing you want to do is turn away from the crater or run or crouch down. Keep your attention toward the lava lake, look up, and move out of the way.
Now the scientists climb the snow-covered volcano.
What really impressed me was seeing these scientists toiling up the side of the volcano with such heavy loads.
The scientists carry large hard-sided boxes.
The temperature on this particular morning was minus 25 degrees Fahrenheit.
Ice covers the scientist's mustache.
Face is frozen.
Clive pulls a generator's ignition cord.
One of them stood out.
Despite having that fantastic lava lake down there, all that energy, we still have to bring old petrol generators up to the crater rim.
Clive yanks the cord. Nearby, another scientist unravels cable.
Man versus Machine, Chapter 53. Professor Clive of Oppenheimer.
On Erebus.
Hands in pockets. Waiting for it to start spontaneously.
I think I'll be waiting a long time.
Ice covers the scientist's beard.
Have you ever seen two men kiss on the top of Erebus before?
Clive hugs the scientist. A scarf covers Clive's neck.
I like working with Harry.
Clive sits with Verna.
Oh. Lorenzis. Thanks, Ace.
It was easy to start a friendship with him. On one of our first days together, he insisted upon training his own camera on me.
Let's turn it off, yeah.
Okay. Do you see them only in destructive terms, volcanoes?
No, I do not. Something different. It's good that they are there, and the soil we are walking upon is not permanent. There's no permanence to what we are doing. No permanence to the efforts of human being, no permanence to art, no permanence to science. There is something of a crust that is somehow moving and makes me fond of a volcano to know that our life, human life, animals can only live and survive because the volcanoes created the atmosphere that we need.
Do you have a sense of the different kinds of volcanoes and different eruptions? I know you filmed on La Soufrière de Guadeloupe many years ago, which is a very, well, do you sense differences in the activity here?
Yeah, La Soufrière was very volatile.
White smoke billows from the La Soufrière volcano.
It was all the way back in 1976 when I first filmed the volcano. This was on the Caribbean island of Guadeloupe. The mountain was expected to explode at any moment, and 70,000 people were rapidly evacuated.
Two donkeys walk on a deserted street.
The fear was intense because of the memory of an event that took on apocalyptic proportions.
A photo of a decimated island.
It was known that in 1902, on the neighboring island Martinique, Montanipoli exploded. The signals that La Soufrière issued in Guadeloupe were almost identical to what had happened. It was measured in 1902, so everybody was afraid it would explode, and it would explode with very, very massive force, many times atomic bomb, Hiroshima size. So I was not interested in the volcano. I was interested in one single man who refused to be evacuated. A different attitude towards death. 75,000 people being evacuated, and he stayed on. I actually found him. I find him sleeping. I had to wake him up on camera.
A man lies at the base of a tree, a cat by his head.
And what was wonderful, he was very philosophical, a very poor black farmer. And I sensed that after a while he didn't feel so comfortable with us anymore, and he sat up and started to tie his worn-out tennis shoe. And then all of a sudden he sings a song against the camera, and I knew that was that song over, and we better get out.
Je suis saisie d'amour en la voyant si belle. Vivre sans plaisir, c'est une triste l'esclavage.
Now Clive stands on a grassy hill. Words appear, 10 years after meeting on Mount Erebus.
We met in Antarctica during the shoot of Encounters at the End of the World. And I knew a little bit about you. I'd seen some of your movies when I was a youngster. And I knew something of your reputation. And we, in our field team, we were anxious that you were going to have us propelled down towards the lava lake. There was some concern that you would be looking for lengths of rope with which we could be lowered down within meters of this fiery lake on Mount Erebus volcano. And instead, you were interested in what we were doing and why we were doing it.
For me, there is no personal excitement to go down. There's a curiosity, yes, I would love to see it from close up. But since it is too dangerous, it would be silly.
We have it in some ways similar. You know, we as a volcanologist, of course, there's a risk, yeah, doing the measurements, and you ask yourself, well, is it worth dying to get this measurement? And you know, the answer is no, if you look at it in those terms, but you're always trying to evaluate how far you're going to tolerate the risk. I mean, even, yeah, here, the volcano could explode now and it will be hit by one of these 5-meter, yeah, bombs.
I'm the only one in filmmaking who is clinically sane.
It's very clear.
Taking all precautions.
No, absolutely. I mean, you wouldn't still be here if you were insane. You would have been consumed long ago by a pyroclastic current or a gas flare or a grizzly bear or whatever. So it's quite clear that you're sane. I never doubted that for a moment on our first encounter. Deposited out from the volcanic gas.
Nice.
Werner turns. Clive cranes his neck.
Yeah, good swoosh.
Werner shifts slightly.
We're very blasé about all of this, really.
Yeah. Let it come at us. We face it and step aside.
A man and woman wear heavy winter coats.
We would often discuss the life and work of a French couple, Katia and Maurice Kraft. They were famous for capturing incredible images of volcanoes.
A lava flow rushes behind Katia.
But this meant that they had to get dangerously close to their subject. Too close, as it would eventually turn out.
Katia shields her face with her arm. The lava divides into two streams. Katia walks away from the flow. Now a person in a fire proximity suit walks towards a huge vertical lava plume. The person turns and walks away from the falling lava.
Mm-hmm.
Now another person walks toward billowing smoke. Lava flashes from within the smoke. The person squats near the volcano rim. Bits of lava and ash land on the edge. The person, Maurice, stands. Then he turns and walks away from the rim. He closes his jacket over his camera. Now a person in a fire proximity suit approaches another fast-moving lava flow. Another suited person walks alongside a river of streaming lava. Black molten rock covers the surface of the flow. Using a walking stick, the person walks toward the edge of the flow. The person tests their footing and steps on a higher piece of rock. Now, tumbling lava ignites behind a person in a suit. The person jumps back. The flames burn leaves and grass. Now a chipmunk stands on Katya's lap. It eats. Katya leans over and smiles.
They were both instantly killed by a pyroclastic flow in Japan, together with 41 other people.
Maurice puts on a hat and walks away. Rocks tumble from the side of a mountain. Dust surges outward and upward.
This is the very avalanche of superheated gases that killed them. What is rushing down this slope at over 100 miles per hour has a temperature of more than 800 degrees Fahrenheit.
A van drives behind a man sprinting away from the volcano. The roiling cloud of the pyroclastic flow rushes down toward the buildings below. The billowing smoke and ash grow more dense on the side of the volcano as the hot gas and liquid rock near the buildings. Now a large body of water surrounded by forest. A haze covers land in the distance. Words appear. Lake Toba, Indonesia.
I spent a very formative part of my youth in Indonesia. I came to Toba when I was 19 years old. And actually in Indonesia, I feel like it's my second home. I've come back intermittently over the years, but I immediately feel at home. The smell of the kretek clove cigarettes, the sights, the sounds. It's a very special place to me. And I think my career as a volcanologist was partly formed from that first visit as a 19-year-old.
A volcano.
Indonesia was the right place for an aspiring scientist. In fact, there's no country in the world that has more volcanoes than this one. Clive Oppenheimer took us to Mount Sinabung. It had been relatively quiet the last few years.
Two women hoe a field.
The area we are shooting in right now had been declared a restricted zone with no access allowed to anyone. But as we found farmers working there, we felt reasonably safe.
A charred teddy bear.
Eerie relics remained, though, from an eruption in 2010.
The bear sits near the remnants of a wooden building.
Feeling that this was distant enough in time, no one was expecting what happened next.
Broken planks and beams remain within the building's frame. Now the summit of Mount Sinabung. The volcano erupts. Smoke and ash shoot into the air. The cloud of smoke grows. The plume of smoke stretches high into the air.
Fortunately, this eruption did not hurt anyone, and we quickly left the area.
Smoke travels down the side of the volcano. A TV broadcast subtitled Villages in Ashes After Indonesia Volcano Eruption.
Only a few days later, we saw this on Indonesian television. Seven people were killed in the very spot where we had had our camera.
At least seven dead, many burned in Mount Sinabung eruption. The broadcast shows people fleeing on motorbikes. Men wear surgical masks and carry a body bag. Three emergency personnel close a body bag over a corpse. Men carry a person on a stretcher.
Guys,
A building on a stone terrace.
In order to prevent such catastrophes, Indonesia has set up numerous early warning systems. This is the Babadan Observatory, which monitors Mount Merapi, one of the most dangerous volcanoes in the world.
Clive with Sri Sumarti.
And each of these stations is a seismometer somewhere on Merapi, a different distance, 5-6 kilometers from the summit?
Yeah, that's true. So we have a summit station, we have a southeast station, we have south station in Pelawangan Hill, and also we have on the west of station.
And these real-time data provide one of the most important parts of a volcano monitoring program for assessing what the volcano is doing. It's the heartbeat of the volcano we're
exactly.
This one is the electronic distance measurements. So we have a reflector in the summit of Merapi. Then we're measuring every morning. By this measuring, we've brought in the cone.
So it's measuring, it's firing a laser pulse to a mirror 5-6 kilometers away. The light bounces back and you've measured the distance. And that can show whether the volcano is inflating because magma is rising into the cone. Is that?
That's right. That's the idea for the electronic distance measurements.
In a worst-case scenario, I imagine the observer is at risk if there's a pyroclastic flow. If it's too late for the observer to evacuate, are there any options left?
Yeah, that's the emergency. Then, if it's emergency, we have a bunker.
Clive opens a door.
It's a thick door.
They enter the bunker.
We put the food and also oxygen. We hope that they can survive for 1 month.
It reminds me of the eruption of Mont Pelee in 1902 that killed nearly 30,000 people in the city of Saint-Pierre as the pyroclastic flows reached it. And the only survivor lived because he was the baddest guy in town. He was a criminal. I think he stabbed a prison officer through the cheek with a pencil, and he was put in solitary confinement in a bunker-like cell. All the other prisoners perished, but he survived, albeit badly burnt because there was a tiny grill window in the cell. And he subsequently joined the Barnum and Bailey Circus and was exhibited as a celebrity, as the sole survivor of this eruption.
Smoke billows over a tropical forest. Words appear. Merapi eruption, 2010.
So in 2010, the monitoring was absolutely crucial in forecasting the eruption and its escalation.
The first indication was seismic. A lot of volcanic earthquakes.
A seismograph moves.
It indicates that there is magma moving, also supported by these electronic distance measurements.
And the gas measurements?
Of course.
Clive stands next to a device.
I know this looks pathetic, like a shoebox with a baked bean tin stuck on the end. And it also looks like it's pointing at the ground rather than at the volcano summit over here. But it's something I'm very proud of. It's something that we built in Cambridge. There's a little window here and a mirror and some lenses connected to an ultraviolet spectrometer. And the device measures the emissions of sulfur dioxide from the volcano as the gases rise above the summit. And this is a very important parameter in many volcano monitoring programs around the world. And the forerunner of this device we had working here in 2010, and it played an important role in the hazard assessment. And it's conservatively estimated that something like 20,000 lives were saved because of the effective monitoring of Merapi in 2010 and the evacuation that followed.
On a street, ash covers people's faces and clothes. A woman adjusts a surgical mask.
I'm very happy to see that it's still working. I hold, along with some colleagues, the patent for the original prototype, which we designed more than 10 years ago now. So this technology is now found on volcanoes around the world, and it's revolutionized the monitoring of gas emissions from volcanoes. It's my baby. I'm really glad to see it. I haven't seen it for 2 years.
And here it is, still working.
Clive nods and stares at the machine. Now, people in traditional garb stand in rows beneath the canopy.
Obviously, there was a scientific side to our journey. But what we were really chasing was the magical side. The demons, the new gods. This was the itinerary we had set for ourselves, no matter how strange things might eventually get.
The group walks forward.
Here in the palace of the Sultan of Yogyakarta, dignitaries are charged with the task of reconciling the goddess of the ocean with the demon of the volcano.
The dignitaries carry various items.
The Sultan himself does not participate in the procession. We marveled at his parked Mercedes, wrapped in a bubble of plastic, as if the conceptual artist Christo had just been here.
A Mercedes sits inside a huge plastic bubble. Now the dignitaries gather in a sandy area. Rocks jut from the ground. Some of the dignitaries sit.
The procession stops for a ritual close to the ocean. This will be a reenactment of the sexual union between an ancient sultan and the queen of the sea. A doctoral student of Clive's, Adam Bobet, functioned as our guide.
Every year, they have to reproduce this by giving rituals, by doing rituals in this site, and then giving offerings to the South Sea from the sultan, including his body parts, fingernails, hair, clothes, which they launch into the ocean to appease the queen of the South Sea. As a part of their sexual union, they also created a kind of monster that ended up occupying the volcano.
Adam points.
So this hole is where they will give offerings, because this is the site of the sexual union between the goddess of the sea and the first sultan.
I think it's coming right now. It's a box. This is it.
A dignitary hands a box to another, who stands in the hole. The man in the hole sets it inside. Now two people shovel dirt into the hole.
And now the offerings to the ocean.
A large crowd runs on a beach. A group carries an offering on a wooden pallet. The crowd gathers at the shoreline. Spectators record on cameras and phones. A group of participants wade into the water. On the shore, a group sits with their legs crossed and hands pressed together.
The following day, we witnessed the ritual at the volcano. Merapi, on this morning, was not enshrouded in clouds.
Now a man in the procession carries a box covered by a cloth. Another man holds an umbrella over him. The volcano looms in the distance. Next, a large crowd gathers at a spot on the volcano. A man shows an item to the crowd. Later,
after the ceremony, the crowd went right for the flower petals, an auspicious souvenir.
Members of the crowd reach into a pit. A dignitary holds up a cloth-covered box. Now the forest canopy from a railed walkway above.
More strange magic. Another bewildering alignment, this time between a building and the volcano. Here, barely visible, as if floating in the clouds.
A bird-shaped building.
The awed edifice is still under construction.
Inside the building, stone walls lead to an unfinished ceiling and light shines through flower-shaped windows.
Inside, we found nobody in an empty chair, pretending to watch TV.
A plastic chair faces a TV with static rolling on the screen. Drinks sit on a nearby table. Now a man saws a plank.
On the floor above, we met a few carpenters.
Words appear. Sarman, carpenter. Sarman measures a plank against a portion of the building's frame. Outside, he meets with Adam and Clive.
Yes, I'm one of the workers who's building this place.
What is it? What are you building?
I built this. The owner had a dream. After that, he built this building.
yang punya itu katanya mau mimpi lah istilahnya tuh, mimpi.
A building to be used for prayer.
Bikin ini, bikin rumah untuk doa itu katanya ya. Ya gitu.
It looks like a chicken? It's actually a dove, not a chicken. But maybe it's also related to Merapi?
Maybe the owner thinks that way, pointing it towards Mount Merapi. I'm only an ordinary worker who goes home after working hours.
But it still looks like a chicken, right?
Yes, most people say it's like a chicken. They call it the chicken church.
A soap opera filmed the scene here.
Yes.
Inside the building.
It became popular after the soap opera was shot. Last Saturday, someone from Surabaya, who saw the show, wanted to see the location, so they came here.
Now people approach the building.
Order still is the fact that in this mostly Muslim country, this is a Roman Catholic church. Under the floor, it even has its own catacombs, maybe as a shelter for hermits, as protection against volcanic fallout.
Light shines from a window into a narrow hall within the catacombs. An exposed light bulb hangs from the ceiling of a room in the catacomb. Wood frames and supplies sit on the ground. A painted cross adorns a wall near a doorway. In another room, a man plasters the ceiling. He wipes his spade on the side of his pallet. Then he scoops plaster and applies it. Now lightning flashes in the dark over the peak of a volcano. Smoke billows.
Of all the many volcanoes in Indonesia, there's no single one that is not connected to a belief system.
Smoke rises from adjacent volcano mouths.
For the locals, all this volcanic landscape bears magical names. The night market of the ghosts, the flying foxes, the dancing place of the spirits.
Wisps of smoke rise from a chain of volcanoes. Thick smoke wafts from craters. A tall peak looms in the distance. Trees line the crests of the volcanoes. Clouds shroud a volcano in the forest below. Clive stares.
Back to Lake Toba, where Clive Oppenheimer's scientific journey began.
This is the largest volcanic crater lake on Earth. It extends something like 100 kilometers off into the distance. Frankly, it's too big to film. We should have booked a ticket on the International Space Station to look down from above and appreciate its vast scale.
A NASA photo.
The eruption occurred something like 74,000 years ago. This was a monstrous, stupendous volcanic eruption, one of the very largest that we've documented in all of Earth history for a single event. The skies would have been darkened. There would have been a conflagration across this part of northern Sumatra as the pyroclastic current spread out radially around the crater, igniting all of the tropical vegetation. The eruption produced something like 15,000 cubic kilometers of ash and pumice that was pumped high into the stratosphere and spread across the globe. Enough pumice came out to bury everyone in the United States to head height. It's something like 10,000 times larger than the 1980 eruption of Mount St. Helens. It's 100,000 times greater than the Eyjafjallajökull eruption in Iceland in 2010 that disrupted global aviation. This was the stupendous event in Earth history. And there's even a theory that the eruption almost wiped us out as a species. Based on the genetic pedigree of living humans, we can say that there was a bottleneck in human numbers around this time period. And the link is between the climate change wrought by the eruption, the decimation of tropical vegetation that was the resource base for our ancestors. Perhaps there are as few as 600 of our species left on Earth. We would have been classified as an endangered species. Somehow we rebounded. This theory is very controversial, however, and that's because there's a very limited amount of evidence this far back in time. In particular, there are very few human fossils to try and establish cause and effect. If we want to find human fossils from 74,000 years ago, we better go to Ethiopia. We better go to the Afar region.
Words appear. Afar region, Ethiopia.
This is part of the Danakil Depression, 300 feet below sea level. In terms of average year-round temperature, this is the hottest place on our planet.
A rocky desert.
During summer, temperatures hardly ever dip below 120 degrees Fahrenheit.
A camel caravan.
Working conditions are only tolerable in midwinter, and even then it is extremely hot.
A man stands behind the caravan.
On top of that, this is an area of tribal warfare, and you can only enter it accompanied by armed soldiers.
The man stares ahead. He wears a vest and holds a walking stick in one hand and a branch in the other. Now two women walk across the desert basin.
This depression is only part of a long stretch drift continuing down through all of East Africa. In millions of years, the rift will widen until a strip of the continent breaks off, drifting into the Indian Ocean.
Desert plants grow near a body of water.
In such places, volcanoes form.
Smoke rises from a crater.
This particular one, Erta Ale, is one of the three in the world where magma is directly exposed.
Magma bubbles at the bottom of Erta Ale. A sheet of molten rock closes over the bubbling magma. The sheet slowly drifts.
Erta Ale is also important for its significance to early man. A great amount of obsidian, a volcanic glass, was extruded from the crater.
Clive holds a piece of obsidian.
Look at that, it's translucent at the edges. Beautiful flake. And very sharp still. Could probably shave with that.
Obsidian is very hard and brittle, and therefore fractures with extremely sharp edges. So sharp, in fact, that up until the 1980s, eye operations were performed with obsidian scalpels sharper than any steel.
A herd of goats.
This amazing material has attracted early humans to this landscape as far back as hominids a million years ago.
Paleontologists rope off a dig site.
At this site, a team of paleontologists are extracting artifacts and remains of our direct ancestors, the first Homo sapiens, who emerged in this area 100,000 years ago.
Thin cords form a grid over the site.
What is amazing to me is the fact that the remains are found almost directly at the surface, and more so, why this particular spot and not back there where the goats are roaming.
Now rocks mark the corners of square sections on the grid.
This grid was apparently a tool manufacturing site. Hundreds of obsidian chips are strewn about. Dr. Jonathan Saleh, an Ethiopian scientist, has excavated this prehistoric workshop.
And where did your passion come from? How did you fall into this field?
Well, I studied history for my bachelor's degree, and that's when I started to fall in love. But so history was not deep enough for me, so I wanted to look further back in time and find out what is it really that makes us human? We are a very unique species in a way, like we interact and we collaborate and we cooperate and we produce, we modify our environment. But at the same time, we fight and distract, and we are even a danger to other species and the planet, the fate of the planet as well. And so we are very interesting species. So I wanted to get at the root of all this and see in deep time what underlies all these processes.
Four men carefully excavate.
We're sifting through the trash of humans from 50 to 100,000 years ago. Do you think we have another 100,000 years on planet Earth?
I would say that, you know, another 1,000 years, we will be in a very critical situation. And so we will have to learn from our mistakes, and we'll have to work toward improving the condition of our planet so that it can have the carrying capacity to allow our species to perpetuate.
If you had a time machine and could go to only one time period in the past, when would it be?
It would be exactly this time period, because this is, I believe this is when we started to look like us, and when we as a species started. And so this is before we became, we acquired different skin colors. This is before we acquired different languages and we spread across different geographies. So this is where I want to be, right at the root. And so I would love to express my fascination to this ground by kissing it. And here I go.
Jonathan walks into the grid. He gets on his knees, lowers his head to the ground, and kisses it. Jonathan spreads his arms wide. Now a man wears a baseball cap.
Professor Tim White of the University of California, Berkeley, leads the team here. We were immediately captivated by his wild style of explaining things.
Tim throws sand into the air.
So, look at them.
He throws more sand.
Powder. It blows in the wind. It's very fine grain. It's all floodplain. It's all silt. But it all started as volcanic rock from the highlands, from the rift margin. Ground up over millions of years, distributed out here, and redistributed by the Awash River. If you die today, your body will decompose on a floodplain. If the hyenas don't chew all the bones up, the next time the river floods, this soft, silty material will be carried in, and it will encase your bones. Let's go.
Tim gets into a truck. Now the truck drives down a rocky hill. Bare trees grow from the dry ground.
Dinga, dinga, dinga.
Tim cuts branches with a pair of large pruning shears. Tim puts the mouth of the shears on a branch.
Oh, we're going to call this the Werner Herzog Highway. And what we're doing here is opening up a space for the cars so we can come through with the full crew tomorrow morning to recover the additional pieces of the hominid that we found just up on top there on the eroding sediments. So we like to pull the cars in as close as we can get so we can get all the equipment there. And we'll start an extraction process to pull that hominid out.
The truck continues over the arid landscape toward the crest of a hill. Men walk ahead of it.
How phenomenally lucky are we to have arrived now and you've found this 100,000-year-old human?
This does not happen very often. These hominid fossils are very, very rare. Finding an artifact, that's easier, because during any hominid's lifetime, they can make dozens, thousands of Stone Age calling cards scattered all over the landscape, but they only have one skeleton, one dentition. They only die once. And so think about it. Acres and acres of eroding sediment. How in the world can we find the place where this dead person's bones came to rest and arrive just at the geological moment that erosion is carving these sediments out, exposing these ancient surfaces with the monkeys and the hippos and everything else. Thousands of bones and artifacts all over the surface, and there's one guy in the world. If I had to say, get that guy out here on the surface, he's going to find the hominin. You know who that is? That is Campiro Corrento, the world's greatest fossil finder.
Campiro approaches Tim.
This is Campiro Corrento. He is one of the world's experts, if not the world's expert. He's the guy I want on the aircraft to find things. He can recognize what's an antelope, what's a carnivore, what's a fish, what's a baboon, what's a zebra, what's a giraffe, what's a rhino. He got all that. Not from the whole animal, because you never find the whole animal. You find pieces of animals, pieces of the bones of animals. He knows what they are.
Clive and a paleontologist kneel next to a tray. Pieces of bone lie on top.
You got anything, Tim?
More pieces for the puzzle.
Tim holds a fragment.
Cranial vault piece, freshly out of the ground. That one needs to be squirted off. Mm-hmm. This bone is beautifully preserved, completely silicified, completely fossilized. So we've got now a number of different elements. The most diagnostic and important one, ultimately, will be this one here, which is the top of the left orbit, to sort of place it in Clive's head.
Clive holds the bone fragment in front of his face. He moves it to his head.
Whereabouts?
Other side. There you go.
Okay.
I'm looking into the eye of a Paleolithic hominid that lived here.
Tim holds the bone over Clive's eye.
So it's a three-dimensional jigsaw puzzle.
Tim places two bones together.
Yeah, no one's going to argue that those two pieces fit back together.
That's a nice fit. In evolutionary terms, here in the Middle Awash, we have 6 million years worth of rocks. The ones on the bottom have small-brained, early bipeds. These are close to the top of the succession. These are much more like you and I. They have chins, vertical foreheads. We still have a lot to learn about them, but the importance for humanity is that this is the right time, 100,000 years ago, and the right place, Africa, according to the archaeology and the genetic evidence, to know the people who were the ones who expanded from Africa to Asia, to Europe, and then beyond.
A wide creek.
Well, these people were living here in tropical Africa, dining on hippos. Europe was locked under ice.
A crocodile enters the water.
Let's go get more pieces. Are we ready to rock and roll? Let's get brushes.
Clive and the paleontologist follow Tim.
We've taken all of the surface exposed bone off the surface. We suspect there's going to be subsurface bone in here. We've maximized where we think it is, and now it's a matter of going to the casino and rolling the dice and hoping we're going to get some nice human anatomy fossilized for 100,000 years right out of this unit. But we're just going to brush and find bone. Whoa! There's a piece of bone right there. That one's not identifiable, but it might join other ones and become identifiable. So that's a keeper. Every single piece of bone is a keeper.
Tim, Clive, and the other paleontologists brush the surface. Tim points at the sand.
See the piece?
He lowers his head to the ground and blows. Tim pats his leg and grabs the piece of bone.
So that's a limb bone shaft. I can't tell which limb bone is one of three. It's tibia, humerus, or femur.
Tim grabs another piece.
Here we go. That's a nice shaft piece. Again, it's tibia. It's one of the major long bones. This one, or that one.
Tim pats his arm, his thigh, and his shin.
You can see these things they're completely turned to stone. They're completely fossilized. So they're brittle. And when erosion comes and exposes them, they just shatter. And so we have to be careful to get all of the shattered pieces. My skeleton has 206 bones. Same with this person. They're human. But now we're looking for literally probably 4,000 pieces because all of those bones each shattered
I can always already see something that discriminates you and I, which is we've been here the same amount of time. You've pulled out half a dozen of these bone fragments. I haven't found anything. It's clearly an expertise that goes with this business.
But the greatest thing about the game is the combination of the expertise and the luck.
Like Las Vegas.
Viva Las Vegas.
Courtesy of Bazayu.
Bazayu, got a limb bone shaft. Thank you.
The group continues to brush.
What's wrong over there, Clive?
Tim reaches into the dirt.
Oh! Woo!
There's a shake.
Check it out! Clive!
Tim wipes off a piece of bone. Clive approaches.
Where does it fit?
Check it out. This is a distal humerus. Definitely hominid. It is right down at the end of your upper arm bone. So if we were to place this in our anatomy, we'd set it up something like that.
In the crook of his elbow.
I figured out, Tim, I'm holding the brush wrong. There's got to be something wrong with my technique here.
Come on, Clive. Move over into the hot place there. I'm moving KK out. This is your chance.
You don't think it's too hot for me?
This is your chance. You got to get in here, man. This guy's finding everything.
It was right there. He planted it. It's just to make me look bad, isn't it? I'll stick to volcanology.
Brush, man, brush. He's going to lose this race.
Campiro hands Tim a piece.
Piece after piece after piece after piece. Maybe we'll get it all back together again. If we're lucky. If Clive would just find something.
I'm not going to give up.
Come on, Clive.
Tim brushes a mound. Campiro picks up a rock and drops it. Clive picks up a rock, studies it, and drops it back in the dirt. Clive brushes.
Huh? Look it.
Tim blows the dirt.
Whoa! Bingo!
Is it a human?
Yeah.
All right. He's got it. Clive scores.
Clive holds the bone fragment.
It's such a relief.
He puts the fragment in his palm.
Just out of the dirt. Where it's been 100,000 years, maybe.
Clive holds the fragment between his fingers.
A little piece of my direct ancestor, perhaps.
What we want to do is we want to put this in a separate box.
It's quite heavy. It's fossilized.
Clive stares at the fragment. He rotates it with his fingers.
One skeleton from Kenya. One skeleton from 2 meters up, 500 meters away, in the middle Awash, and this one. That's how rare even partial skeletons of human ancestors are in that time interval. Just the first surface sweep, we've probably got another 30 pieces of this individual, and all of this came out in about 30 minutes of simply sweeping. As these piles that we've swept up go through the sieve, we're going to have a bunch of other pieces of bone that escape the brushing but won't escape our sieve. Hopefully we'll see a cranium take shape and we'll come to know the anatomy of this person.
I mean, it's just what a phenomenal cornucopia for half an hour's work with a dustpan and brush. It's just sensational.
One of three in Africa ever recovered. Your timing was very good.
Campiro moves his arms.
Wait a minute. There's a conso dance going on here in the background.
It's going to be good.
This is going to be good. Oh, Moya means in Afarinha, head.
Campiro points to a fragment in the dirt.
Got the Moya. Woo! What we call Moya.
Tim claps. Clive wiggles his shoulders.
The extraction begins.
This fragment is of particular importance as it is part of the cranium.
Time for a Shakespearean moment, perhaps, to soliloquize on my deep ancestry.
Clive holds the skull fragment. Tim cranes his neck to look.
I can see the curvature.
It's the biggest piece we have so far.
Now a windshield frames an SUV driving across the arid landscape.
As dusk came, we made our way to the volcano.
Magma seethes.
Looking into the magma at night, the interior of our planet reveals its strange beauty.
A bubble reaches the surface. Glowing, jagged lines separate sections of the molten rock. The melted slag pulsates at the edges of the black surface. The magma shifts and bubbles. Red-hot filaments feather from the cracks. Lava surges up against the edge of the pit. A darkened ledge separates and tumbles in. Glimmering bubbles surface and erupt. Next, the blazing edges of the magma recede from the edge of the pit. A large illuminated bubble breaks the surface. The molten pool writhes and churns. Now two islands rise from the horizon. Words appear. Westman Islands, Iceland.
Compared to Ethiopia, Iceland's history is a mere blip in time. Less than 1,200 years ago, it was settled by Norsemen.
On a boat heading between two massive rocks.
All of Iceland is volcanic, including the Westman Islands to the south.
Words appear. Town of Heimaey.
Out of nowhere, in the early morning hours of January 23rd, 1973, a trench of fire opened right at the edge of the town of Heimaey.
Footage from a boat shows a huge shower of lava.
The eruption occurred without any previous warning signs.
A small village sits on a ridge near the ocean. The lava rises into the sky behind nearby hills, a curtain of fire. Waves crash onto the shore. A large cross sits on top of an arch over a gate. Behind the gate, smoke rises into the sky. Another cross sits in the center of the barred gate. Lava sprays into the sky, obscuring the hills in the distance. A ridge separates a house from the eruptions. Smoke and lava shoot into the sky from the mountains above a group of homes. Wisps of smoke rise from the ground.
As bad as it looks, no one lost their lives here. The fishing fleet had just returned to harbor and rescued many of the inhabitants.
Hardened lava fills the streets and covers homes. A house-sized pile of volcanic rock sits between two buildings.
40 years after the event, Clive Oppenheimer brought us here. Grass has grown again, and there are still curtains in the windows.
A curtain hangs in a destroyed house.
But Heimaey was hardly an isolated event. Not a season goes by in Iceland without an eruption.
A road stretches into the distance. Ash fills the sky. An eruption rises into the air.
This event happened in 2010 and is remembered as the ash cloud that paralyzed air traffic for weeks.
A dark cloud.
Very quickly, the heat from the eruption melted the thick ice covering on top of the mountain, creating enormous floods.
Lightning flashes in the giant ash cloud. Eroded rock pours from a hole in the side of a mountain. Ice and snow cover the top of the mountain. A landslide travels down a mountain. Now, rushing water moves under a bridge. Dark clouds stretch across the horizon. Men stand near a car on a road below. Now a fog of ash obscures a man walking behind a herd of horses. Next, a man rides a horse. Another horse runs alongside a pickup truck. A group of men wear gas masks.
But an event of this magnitude is nothing compared to earlier eruptions in Iceland. This area is the site of the so-called Lucky Eruption. Beginning on June 8, 1783, this entire landscape exploded into flames, as far as the eye could see from horizon to horizon.
Hills and rugged rock formations fill the landscape. Now a man climbs a rock formation. He balances on an elevated section.
The molten rock came up to the surface and rent open a 27-kilometer-long fissure that stretches in this direction for something like half of that distance.
Clive extends his arm.
Overall, about 140 vents were active, building up cones above them with fire fountains rising into the air. And after a few months, the fissure opened up in this direction. Again, another 13, 14 kilometers or so. And another few dozen vents opened up, and they spewed out lava to the northeast of us. Everything we see now has been set in stone, and the lava has solidified and frozen. But if we'd been here at the time, we would have seen jets of fire, fountains of fire, rising a kilometer and a half into the air, and then cascading down to the ground again. And that built up the cones like the one that we're standing on now. And from the bases of these cones, lava gushed out at a phenomenal rate. This is very, very hot lava, very, very fluid, and it poured down the valleys, filling them to depths of 100, 150 meters.
A lava flow travels quickly, careening and splashing in waves.
These primordial occurrences influence the sense of mythical poetry of the Icelanders. There is a text that defines the spirit of the people. It exists only in a single manuscript. For Iceland, it is as important as the Dead Sea Scrolls are for Israel.
In a library.
The codex was given as a present to the King of Denmark by an Icelandic bishop in the 17th century. Hence its name, the Royal Codex, or Codex Regius. In 1971, Denmark returned it to Iceland. Knowing that it constituted the soul of the country, the Codex was put on Denmark's largest battleship and escorted by a whole fleet. No amount of money in the world would be enough to purchase this manuscript from Iceland, although it is battered and crumpled and filled with holes.
Text fills the worn pages.
In the opening passage, called the Prophecy of the Seeress, there is an apocalyptic vision of the end of the pagan gods. This seems to describe a huge volcanic event.
A lava flow nears the ocean.
Neath the sea, the land sinketh. The sun dimmeth. From the heavens fall the fair bright stars. Gushed forth steam and gutting fire. To very heaven soar the hurtling flames. The fates I fathom, yet farther I see. Of the mighty gods, the engulfing doom. Comes the darksome dragon flying, Nithog, upwards from the Nitha fells. He bears in his pinions, as the plains he overflies, naked corpses. Now he will sink.
Erupting lava sprays. A lava flow travels from the mouth of the eruption. Black rock covers a reservoir of cooling lava. Lava gushes from another volcano. A lava flow travels away from the eruption. Steam rises on the ground next to the flow. The flow divides into two streams. The streams come back together. Pillars connected by chains form a fence. A mist shrouds the area. Words appear. Mount Paektu, DPRK, North Korea.
Right on the border with China lies a volcano in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, better known in the West as North Korea. It has been inactive for more than 1,000 years, but it plays a huge role in the imagination of the people. For millennia, it was considered the mythical birthplace of the Korean nation. Today, the socialist government co-opts this myth.
Figures emerge from the mist.
This is the site of pilgrimages. Out of the mists, we saw a formation of uniformed men with a flag emerging. We believed they were soldiers, but it turned out they were university students come to rejoice in the power that emanates from this place.
A man in the front of the group holds a flag. They march in unison. Then they stop. The uniformed men approach the fence. Some take off their caps and wave them over their heads. The hill on the other side of the fence leads to a lake below. Mist covers the lake.
And now they are singing in praise of Mount Paektu.
A man waves his cap and places it back on his head. Another man holds his arm around a companion's shoulder.
Everything is different in North Korea. Imagine if these were students at a campus in California.
The students pump their fists to the rhythm. Shrouds the volcanic lake.
A unique opportunity presented itself to us. The near-impervious country opened its doors to a joint scientific program between the University of Cambridge and North Korean volcanologists. And so we were invited to film there.
The students march in place.
But everything we saw was an act of presentation, and we went for it. There is no other way to see this enigmatic country other than how it wants to present itself. In propaganda films seen frequently on North Korean television, the images display monumental unity and fervent emotion, all dedicated to the leadership.
Footage shows a crowd of chanting women raising their hands. In a city square, a crowd forms an image of the North Korean flag and a message. Thousands of people in different formations move in unison. A large statue of a single man stands on top of a float. A procession of soldiers follow the float. The statue stands with its arm outstretched. Banners adorn a nearby building. A group of men in suits wear medals. The crowd waves frantically and people weep. Now Clive stands on the crater rim.
One thing that's remarkable and I'm very aware of as I work here is the sanctity of this mountain. This has a very long history going back 5,000 years as the mythical birthplace of the Korean people from this volcano. And through the medieval period and to the more modern period, this is the sacred mountain of the revolution where the struggle was fought against Japanese occupation 70 years ago. And the spirit of the mountain is in all the Korean people. And this is something very, very special about this place.
Clive sits in a boat. A man rows.
It seems like we're on a tranquil boat trip on a Norwegian fjord, but actually we're at ground zero of this, what was a most monumental volcanic eruption nearly 1,100 years ago, the so-called Millennium Eruption.
The crater here is about 3 miles across, and actually these cliffs are all part of the crater rim all around us, 360 degrees. The amount of pumice that came out in the eruption would be enough to bury the whole of New York City. Only the highest buildings would poke out of the top. In a way, if you look at the crater surrounding us and imagine that once there was a cone built over our heads, that missing volume alone accounts for a huge amount of rock and pumice and lava. So this has been spewed out over the Korean Peninsula, it's in parts of China, it's in parts of Russia, and there's even about 3 inches of ash that fell over parts of Japan that you can still find today.
Mist covers the peaks of the crater.
Around 10 years ago, there was a swarm of earthquakes that were detected by sensitive instruments around the mountain, and that really ignited the scientific interest in the volcano and whether there might be signs of reawakening.
Now Clive and another man meet with North Korean scientists.
Over the last few years, we've built a really strong and unique collaboration with scientists from Pyongyang who've worked here for 10, 20 years. So they have very detailed knowledge of the structure of the volcano, so we've learnt a lot from them. It's very difficult for scientists here to attend international conferences. So we've really shared our experiences and expertise to better understand this volcano.
James Hammond.
So 2 years of data.
So yeah, we've collected 2 years of seismic data, which is pretty incredible. The seismometer sitting here will record all the earthquakes.
It looks just like a paint pot linked to a laptop, and yet that's recorded this unique data set. It's really something.
It looks can be deceptive. It's an incredibly sensitive instrument in there. So it will record, just minor movements. Even us walking around here will be creating noise.
So this is Mr. Yun Young Gun. He's the vice director of the Earthquake Administration and kind of leads the DPRK side of the project.
Han Myung Il, director of the Institute of Simultaneous Interpretation, Pyongyang University of Foreign Studies.
The Earthquake Administration of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea pays special attention to this project of international joint research. Greater importance is given to this mountain just because around this mountain, our great leader, President Kim Il-sung, fought against the Japanese imperialists.
A falling cloth unveils a statue.
Kim Il-sung, the founding father of the communist North Korean state, appropriated the myth of the volcano. He established his secret military headquarters in a forest right here at the foot of the mountain, thus transferring its power and dynamic into his revolution.
A group of students pose near a statue. A boy runs away from the group.
This monument is a gateway to the sacred ground.
The statue depicts a group of Korean soldiers charging forward. A man holds a rifle. Another holds a rifle with a bayonet. A third waves and shouts back at the group. A woman in uniform marches forward. She turns and points to a sculpture.
This group sculpture is about the camping life of the guerrillas in Cheongbong camp. They were very much moved to put their foot first time on the homeland, and they could not sleep. So you can see the lady guerrillas who are now sewing the buttons to the clothes, a guerrilla who is reading a book under the fire. Little guerrilla is now dreaming about returning back home after the liberation of the country, and one of the guerrilla is now playing the pipe.
The guide points to another sculpture.
Those guerrillas are now rejoicing over the site of Mount Daegu. On the 21st of July 1979, our great leader, General Lee Kim Jong-il, came to this place and particularly highly appreciated that lady who is now standing in solitude was greatly depicted.
Now the guide walks on a path through a forested area. She approaches the lake edge. A sculpture stands on a rock just off the shore.
여기가 조금 이로못갑니다.
This is the biggest lake number one.
이오못이 있습니다.
And over there we have the lake number two.
조금 더 올라가서 삼오못이
있습니다. And a little further up we have the lake number three.
위대한
When our great leader General Lee Kim Jong-il came here in March 2003, he highly appreciated the beauty of these trees.
Conifer branches extend out from their trunks. Now a group poses for a photo in front of a mosaic. A young girl follows a woman in uniform. A man trails behind. The mosaic depicts a mother holding a child. The father holds the child's hand.
This is the mosaic mural painting, The Glory of February.
뷰카는 탄생 한 달 맞으시는 위대한 장군님을 축하해 주시는 오보이 수령님과 항일의 여성용 김동숙 어머님 모습을 형상했습니다.
The mural painting represents the great leader President Kim Il-sung and the anti-Japanese heroine Kim Jong-suk who are celebrating their first birth anniversary of the great leader Kim Jong-il.
A uniformed man carries a flag. A group follows behind him.
And here, the secret log cabin of Kim Il-sung. Daily thousands of people make their pilgrimage to this humble place.
The group approaches the cabin.
In the Christian world, this would be like visiting the birthplace of Jesus, the stable in Bethlehem.
Inside the cabin, three photos hang on a wall.
For North Koreans, the founding father of their revolution still lives on. Kim Il-sung became president of the nation and then president for life. After his death, he was declared president for eternity.
The group stands at attention.
The propaganda appears to create a quasi-religious experience.
In the cabin, a stack of folded blankets sits on a box.
Actually, the life in the secret camp in those days was so difficult that they had no blanket at all. That is why the guerrilla soldiers collected their wads from their own padded clothes and then made that blanket for our dear Kim Jong-il.
Three soldiers pose. Then they walk away.
The birthplace of the socialist revolution manifests itself in collective formations of the North Koreans. In the country's biggest stadium, more than 100,000 people participate in creating a unique art form.
Dancers sway in front of a backdrop of Kim Il-sung's cabin.
The picture of the hut in the snow is not a painting. It is made of human pixels. And this is how it's done. A pre-arranged pattern of color cards is held and flipped over in sync.
Now human pixels depict a sunrise.
Here, the rising sun over the landscape of Mount Paektu.
The synchronized dancers spin and move beneath the image of mountains and the sun. They form lines like the rays of the sun. The pixels shift into an image of a horse pulling a chariot. Then into two portraits.
And here, father and son of the revolution. All this appears like a cosmic metaphor for a society aligned in a unified pattern behind a common ideology.
A group dances in the center of the larger formation. They leap in the air in unison. Dozens of separate groups perform complex acrobatics in unison. Now a man stares up at an enormous statue.
But in all this display of the masses, I find an underlying emptiness and solitude.
A giant statue of a soldier stands next to a geometric sculpture. A group of women stand on an escalator traveling downward.
Because of the North Korean ideology of political and economic self-reliance, and because of internationally imposed sanctions, the country is unique. The population at large has very limited contact with the outside world. There are no international phone lines or internet available to the public, no radio or television from the outside world.
In a subway station,
To our eyes, it is strange to see people not glued to their cell phones.
People gather around a display.
There is no advertising anywhere. Instead, just the ever-present propaganda. There are no newsstands, only the official party newspaper on display.
A train enters the Immaculate Station. People wait on the platform. A man reads the newspaper display. The train doors open. People enter. A uniformed woman holding a rod with a circle attached to the top of it walks past the open train doors. She turns. The woman raises the rod. The train moves out of the station. Now, at the top of a staircase, a mural of Kim Jong-il atop a mountain.
In the subway, in the streets, almost everywhere, you'll find pictures of the leaders, always in the vicinity of the volcano.
A photo of Kim Jong-un in a crowd of soldiers. Another photo of Korean leaders in front of the volcano. Now at Mount Paektu.
Back on the mountain, we spoke to a historian who was assigned to us. We asked him about the photos and the precise location of where they had been taken.
He probably stood exactly at the place you are standing now.
주령님께서 지금 우리가 서 있는 이 자리에 오셔서 사진을 찍으셨습니까?
이 자리는 아니고 저쪽 저기 저기 있습니다.
Kwon Sung An, Academy of Social Sciences.
Not this place, but up there on the Jangun Peak.
Yeah. They're famous photos, you know them.
A photo of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il.
About this monument, it dates back to what time, roughly?
이게 언제 세워진 비석입니까?
비석으로서는 이게 쓰여진 것도 있지만 20세기 초에
It dates back to the early 20th century. It was erected by the heavenly people living around this area, and according to the inscription on the monument, they prayed to Mount Paektu and Lake Chun here to give a birth to a prominent person who can give prosperity and happiness to the Korean nation.
And the person materialized.
Right. 그 기원이 실현이 돼서 실현님께서 탄생하셨겠습니다.
아, 옳습니다.
You're quite right. This kind of miserable nation was restored and saved just by our great leader, the peerless patriot Kim Il-sung, who fought against the Japanese imperialists.
And how do you feel as a historian with all the thousands of years behind you? How do you feel personally? Is there pride? Is there patriotism?
우리 민족성원이라면 누구나 느끼는 바이지만
My question was meant to elicit a personal response. However, personal opinions seem to us a mirror image of the omnipotent ideology of the people and their leadership.
매번 오를 때마다 새삼스럽게 느끼곤 합니다.
All the Korean people frequently climb up to this mountain, but every time, whenever they climb up this mountain, they have a new feeling, a solemn feeling, and at the same time, they make up a new determination to work harder for the country with patriotism. And all the Korean people are now singing the song, whose title is Let Us Go to Mount Paektu. And it clearly reflects the spirit of the Korean people.
On a stage. Four women stand behind a group of young girls. Now young girls wear doctor and nurse costumes and pretend. In a gym, a boy stands on a miniature basketball court. Other children play and exercise. A boy and girl lift toy barbells over their heads. A boy dunks in a hoop. Another boy picks up the ball. A mural depicts Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung surrounded by children. On stage, a girl pins a red star to a boy's chest. Four other boys stand on a stage with red stars on their chests. The children march off stage. A young girl plays piano. A woman stands with the girl. The girl bows. Now two men walk on the side of a mountain.
We are back now where we started, the Vanuatu archipelago, this time on Tanna Island in the south. There is an active volcano here, Mount Yasur.
Mist moves over a mountain. A group of four people stand on a ridge in the distance. A man looks into a camera. Another man stands next to him. Two other men sit on the ridge. On the interior of the ridge, mist hugs the walls of the large crater. At the bottom of the pit, magma bubbles. Smoke and magma shoot into the air. The glowing liquid rock percolates. Smoke rises. From above, two scientists in protective suits walk toward the edge of a cliff. The smoke moves toward them. Inside the crater, magma swells up and spews sparks. Ash and bits of magma fly. A wave of molten rock lands on the edge of the pit. The scientists stand on the crater's rim. One stands near the edge. Magma undulates. Clumps of sizzling liquid spray upward. The scientist backs away from the edge. He holds his hand on his forehead and watches. Ash rises. Flakes fall toward the pit as the lava inside ebbs. Smoke rises from the crater. Light from the volcano glows in the distance.
Similar to North Korea, this volcano has created a new god. The name of the deity, John Frum, a mythical American GI who descended from the clouds.
In a longhouse.
Each Friday night, the islanders celebrate his cult.
Children dance. Nearby, adults sit in a circle. In the center of the circle, six men strum guitars. Others on the outside clap. In the dim light, women in dresses dance. An older man claps his hands. An infant sits at the center of the guitar circle. As the ceremony continues, older men sit on a bench outside of the circle. The group of children face the circle. A boy walks away from the longhouse. In the distance, silhouettes of trees obscure the volcano's glow. Daytime, a bearded man stares forward.
Chief Isaac of this John Frum village tightly controls the dogma of the new faith. Different denominations and even a schism in the church seem to have materialized. And so we were only allowed to speak to him and his son.
An American flag flaps on a bamboo pole.
He flies the stars and stripes because John Frum is an American who promises to return with copious cargoes of consumer goods.
Now Clive sits with Isaac.
I understand that John Frum one day will appear to all the people and that he will bring many things, chewing gum, fridges, Cadillacs, maybe Boeing airplanes.
He thinks that... He says that it is a promise that was made one day. He says that it is a promise made by the spirit. That one day it'll be like the Americans will do all that.
Is John Frum like a god?
John Frum is like a god to us.
The one god.
Isaac nods.
And
John Frum is like a god, and it is like... John Frum is like a gate. It is like Jesus. You have to pass through before going to God.
What happens when people die?
His believing is that when the dead are buried, they are in a room, waiting for the last kingdom.
Will they meet John Frum in the last kingdom?
So he thinks that the last kingdom, John Frum is like a walking person, like Jesus. In the last kingdom, it is thought that he'll be searching for people.
Clive sits with the younger man.
His son had direct encounters with John Frum.
You're next in line to be chief of this John Frum village, and I understand that you have spent time living in the volcano. You spent some nights there. What were you doing, and did you speak to John Frum while you were there?
Words appear. Molly Isaac.
He's answering that yes, he's been there. He stayed there for one full night. He had seen someone, and he spoke to him.
It said that John Frum uses the volcano as a portal, a doorway to travel from Tanna to America. Does John Frum live inside the volcano?
John?
Molly blinks.
The money Jesus, in our own.
He's telling us that John Frum has a special room that he's living in. But there is one day that we will meet him in a different form of a person, like Jesus.
On the volcano, Clive wears a gas mask. Another man holds a camera nearby.
When I was on the volcano, I found it amazing to watch, but also quite terrifying. How did you feel spending a whole night up in the crater? Were you afraid?
Magma flies into the air.
He's telling us that when he went there and spent the night, he wasn't afraid. Because he knows that that is God. And he's the one that's allowing him to go there.
Magma sprays.
So he went inside the volcano, and he saw him, and he spoke to him. They had a conversation.
Molly nods.
Are you allowed to tell us what the conversation was about?
He says that the message that the spirit gave to him, he didn't tell to his father and even the followers that are following John Frum. It is only for him.
If I'm a volcano man, you can't whisper it to me in my ear.
Molly shakes his head. He scratches his head. In a village, Molly stands with a young child. Nearby, other villagers stare. The villagers move into the distance. Huts stand on the dry ground. A single piece of bamboo stretches into the sky. Trees and thick vegetation stretch away into the landscape. In a pit, magma churns and splashes.
It is hard to take your eyes off the fire that burns deep under our feet. Everywhere, under the crust of the continents and seabeds. It is a fire that wants to burst forth, and it could not care less about what we are doing up here.
Ash and blobs of magma fly.
This boiling mass is just monumentally indifferent to scurrying roaches, retarded reptiles, and vapid humans alike.
A churning fountain of lava sprays above the edge of the pit.
When I went there,
Mile.
I started to walk to the lava lake. I didn't think that I would see something like what as I saw. And once I looked down there, I thought that I was looking at the sea water.
Gentle waves lap against a rocky shoreline.
But it was red.
Magma surges.
And I didn't understand. I started to think about why there's a water there and the water is red. And I didn't understand. I thought of perhaps this fire will someday come through the seawater.
A wave crashes over cascading lava.
So I was very frightened.
Rivulets of lava pour into the sea.
According to our culture, I think the volcano will destroy everything. I believe that, because I heard about from various people that there are volcanoes around the world. And I think that, I believe that someday this volcano will erupt and the one at Low Baby, and then we'll join together, we'll burn everybody. This is what I'm thinking of.
A lava flow.
I think everything will melt. That's what I'm thinking. Everything will melt. The stone, the soil, trees and everything will melt. Like water.
Striations form on the crust of the oozing lava flow.
That's why I believe that this volcano will destroy this world someday.
Mael turns. Ash shoots from a bubbling pit of magma. The magma level rises in the pit. Magma flakes spray. Then fiery plumes rise. The magma recedes. Ash swirls over the bubbling pit. Magma sprays in every direction. A plume of molten rock rises from the pit. Directed, written, and narrated by Werner Herzog. Inspired by the book Eruptions That Shook the World, written by Clive Oppenheimer. Volcanologist, Clive Oppenheimer. Producers, Andre Singer, Luki Stipatic. Editor, Joe Beeney. Associate editor, Alex Bush. Director of photography, Peter Zeitlinger, ASC. Associate producer, Anna Godas. Executive producers, Richard Melman, Vanessa Dillon, Lisa Nishimura, Jason Spingarnkopf, Adam Del Deo. assistant cameraman and second camera unit, Casper Callis, production sound, Paul Paragon, drone operator, Rob Anderson, head of production, Pat Footer, assistant producer, Adam Turner, production assistant, Claire Kessy, archive researcher, Elizabeth Klink, development producers, Figs Jackman, Ed Dallow, music supervisor, Gary Welch, Bree Winwood, completion guarantor, Film Finances, Inc., Frank Isaac. Sound services by Warner Brothers Post-Production Services. Supervising sound editor, sound designer, Laurent Kosayan. Re-recording mixer, Laurent Kosayan. Dialogue supervisor, Joel Doherty. Mix technician, Sean Madsen. ADR mixer, Jason Oliver. Music. Thou, O Savior, Orient of Orients, hast come to visit us from on high. Recordere Yazu Pie. Auf dem Gebirge. Hat man ein Geschrei gehuret. SWV 396. Magnificat in G minor, RV 611, Ed Malipiero. Hermose of the Christmas Eve, Camplin by the Sea Wave. Overture, Lohengrin Prelude. Glory to God on High from All Night Vigil, Vespers. Kvalit imie Gospodne. Praise ye the name of the Lord. From All Night Vigil Vespers. Praise ye the name of the Lord. Copyright 2016, Spring Films Limited and Werner Herzog Films, GmbH. Letters pop out from a white background, then turn red. Netflix.